Hello.
Yo.
Welcome.
It's January 16th. We're back in Lark and there's a nice fire next to us.
Yeah. It's really cold up here, but it's good with that.
Yeah. But tonight's show is all about mobilizing for 2009. There are loads of summits coming up and we figured we'd let you know where they are and who's organizing for them and, you know, just basic info, but some...
It's a chance to plan your holidays around upcoming events.
Although, honestly, they aren't really activist holidays, are they? You're people are, you know, if you go and you should actually do something when you're there, right? Yeah. Not just like lounge around in the sun and stuff.
No. But if you've got to save holidays from work, these are the time to book it for.
Exactly. So some of the things you're going to be listening to tonight include several interviews, actually. An interview that we did with Mel from Platform about COP15. And an interview with Dissent, the French network, about NATO this year, and another one with the War on Want, who are talking about the G20 event that will be happening in London. And we're also featuring lots of interesting music tonight.
We are. We started the show off with a band from Nottingham called Project Notion, the Ethereal Apparatus. And the song we had was Constellate in Cubism.
Wow.
So, which was good.
Intense. And we're also going to be talking a little bit about how to prepare for big demonstrations. And we're going to have a recipe as well, some pecan pies on the menu for some lucky folks in the studio tonight.
Hey.
They're so excited. I could just see it all over their faces. Yeah.
They'll look more excited once they have the sugar, though.
Yeah, they will. Infinitely more so. Okay, so...
Yeah,
I think it's time to go into an interview with Mel from Platform about the COP15.
Yeah, Patrick did this one. Very good.
Big up.
COP15 is not a lineup of 15 COPs, but it refers to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change Conference of Parties, of which the one happening in Copenhagen in Denmark in December of this year will be the 15th Conference of Parties. So that's why it's getting called COP15. And essentially, it's an attempt to ratify a Kyoto 2, so a second Kyoto Protocol on global greenhouse gas emissions and on climate change. So through the process over the past 15 years, the COP14 was in Poznan, last December just gone, COP13 in Bali the year before. People might remember the protests from that event. But throughout the process, there's often been people blaming the US for being a sticking block. However, at this stage, that's no longer possible. And it's become apparent that what is happening is the COP process is itself entirely undemocratic. And rather than being a space for civil society via their nation states to somehow come to an agreement to solve the problem of climate change or to find solutions and to act on climate change, it's becoming yet another place where capitalist forces impose their logic and big corporations make a lot of money. So what we've seen is that the aviation industry has remained untouched by international laws and air fuel prices have remained artificially low. We've seen carbon trading processes pushed through as a way for governments to buy their way out of reducing carbon emissions. And we've seen EU biofuel obligations put in place, which are causing widespread destruction of ecosystems on which we depend. So across the board, we're seeing further problems emerging out of these international negotiations rather than solutions. For some people, a response to the event taking place in December in Copenhagen might be to demand things of their governments, to say, well, you know, we want you to find solutions at home. If you're going to be having these talks in an international arena, then there must be no new coal in the UK, for example. However, as people have attended the process so far, there have been massive protests at the events from groups from across the world saying that their views and their livelihoods and their demands are not being responded to. As the conference holds nation states as the key negotiators and decision makers, it also receives a lot of input from corporate lobbyists who attend the event and have space at the event to represent their opinions. Meanwhile, civil society groups are often left on the outside. And so over the past few months, in preparation for COP15, which in some sense is one of the biggest decision-making processes of its kind, as I say, it's going to attempt to ratify a Kyoto 2, so this will be the newest piece of international agreements on climate change since 1999. So social movements have been engaging in meetings in Copenhagen and in Poland over the past few months. And the big question of these meetings, which have been happening with groups from around the world, is the question of whether to cheer them on, whether to talk over them or whether than to stop them going in the first place, i.e. the attendees of this conference, the nation states and the corporate lobbyists. And a feeling which has been emerging is that perhaps a bad deal is actually worse than no deal at all. Over the coming months, and actually in March, the social movements are hoping to come to an agreement as to what position they want to take. And a lot is at stake here because for many southern countries and for many small island states, the potential of this agreement could be their lives, could be their livelihoods, could be their futures, because the threat that climate change puts on them is so immediate. However, there are further fears that anything that goes through, anything that the people present in those negotiations, the nation states, under the influence of the corporate lobbyists, any laws that do go through will in fact be detrimental to the cause of climate justice. For many people, actually potentially stopping the event taking place is the best plan of action that they can see. There's a comment that was made in Poland by Henry Derwent, who is the CEO of the International Emissions Trading Association, which is essentially just a massive corporate lobbyist, who in Bali had 7% representation at the event, whereas Friends of the Earth International had less than 1%. And he commented while he was in Poland, "It's going to take at least a riot to make any difference to the extraordinary slow process." And I think that's quite a pertinent point, to be honest, because it probably will take a riot for us to be able to stop more totally unjust laws which finance climate change in a way which just makes money for big corporations and does not do anything to address the problem of ecological debt that the North owes the South for causing climate change in the first place, does nothing to address the fact that the impacts of climate change are going to be felt in the South first, and does nothing to effectively reduce carbon emissions so that we can stop ourselves from instigating the feedback mechanisms which will cause runaway climate change. So, as Henry Derwent has suggested, perhaps it is a riot that is needed to stop this totally undemocratic process from going ahead.
All right, thanks for that, Mel. I was just wondering, could you go into a little bit more specifics about the Counter Summit? So could you just kind of tell us what groups are going to participate in the Counter Summit and what kind of shape do you expect it to take?
If you go to www.climax2009.org, you'll be introduced to the Danish group who are coordinating events in Copenhagen. They're planning a climate camp for this summer, and they're also planning a convergence camp for the event itself in December. And so what we might all imagine that will be is a beautiful utopia of seriously sustainable ways of living, and groups from all over the world who have been, I think at the past few social movement gatherings, there have been over 80 or perhaps even over 100 different groups represented and countries represented, definitely over 50, I think. And so there will be a lot of people in one space ready to talk about beautiful visions of how we can actually save our planet from an ecological catastrophe.
If people can't get over to Copenhagen, I mean, is there anything that they can do in the UK, or is there any events happening in the UK?
As of yet, I'm not sure, but let's get ready to organise. This is a big one. I think that there are groups starting to plan to cycle to Copenhagen from the UK. So if that was a route that made it more appealing for people to come. But I imagine that there will be plans made, but I think that the question that people might want to be asking themselves is whether they want to make demands of the government in their role as negotiators within this process, or whether the evidence of what our government does, as we've seen so far, and has been emphasised to us this week with the decision to go ahead with the third runway at Heathrow, or so they think, not that they'll get a chance to do that, but whether or not to demand something of the government in this process, or whether or not to say, we've seen what you've done so far, we don't trust you, we want to stop you from going ahead with this, and we want to force you out of your position of power in this situation.
And, I guess just finally, how successful do you think the counter-summit can be and the opposition to the summit can be?
One thing I would say is that I think already this process of social movements coming together in this way is actually something that is a big success. And so for anybody who attends and who participates in the social movements event, in the actions, I think that will be a really, really important experience for them. I think that's one of the key things that will hopefully come out of it, is that people will participate and people will, look at what is happening and, look at the whole process in whatever does go ahead and perhaps see, who are the big forces of power here and take note that it's massive corporate lobbyists influencing nation states which do bow to their demands and do push through legislation which supports profit and does not in any way help save the planet. So I think that process itself is one of the key things that will come out of this mobilization. And on top of that, there's a discussion for us all to look into regarding the local activism that we're involved in and the kind of the global processes, or maybe the global activism that some of us might be involved in. And, some people have commented that perhaps there is a contradiction there, that you only need to focus on what's happening at home. And I guess I would say is that, of course, the local activism that we might be involved in from any level, from homes and neighbourhoods to works and communities, campaigning on a national level, and then to any international activism that people might be involved in, they are all linked up, they are all part of the same picture, and we need to find ways to link them up most strongly to really have effect. We're only really going to challenge the profit-driven motives on both levels, at a local, at a national, and at an international level.
Okay. Pretty inspiring stuff there. Right, well, thanks a lot for joining us, Mel. Best of luck with everything.
Yeah, you too. Take it easy.
All right. Thank you.
Hey.
Yo, you're back with the island.
That was 52 Commercial Road there.
Yeah, super chilled out track. Hope you didn't fall asleep.
Yeah, really good. That's an exclusive to us, by the way. Just released.
Sweet.
Nice. So, cheers, dudes. They play all the time down Rampart, so...
Good friends of the No Borders gang.
Absolutely. When they show up.
Dude, No Borders of 52.
It's debatable.
Okay. nice bit of back and forth there. So this show is all about like the mobilizations that are coming up in 2009. I guess the big one on the activist calendar has always been the G8.
When is that, Patrick?
So that is fucking... you reckon the program here, man. We're asking one question at a time. It's this year, anyway.
Okay.
Who knows?
Soon.
Soon, yeah. It's in the summer sometime, anyway. Find it out. But anyway, none of us knew where it was.
Or when it is.
Where it is exactly. I mean, it's in Italy. We'll give you a big clue at that. And we'll give you an even bigger clue. It's on an island in Italy that's part of Italy. So... we're going to have the first competition we've ever had.
Spur of the moment
competition, which is the first person to email us in before the end of the show, which is supposed to be at 11 o'clock, but it'll probably be closer to 11:30. First person to email us in the location of the GA conference this year wins a free Distant Island T-shirt, limited edition. So answers please to distantisland@riseup.net.
Cool. And so as promised, we're going to talk a little bit about how to prepare for a demonstration because, you know, you don't just walk into a demo. Like, you know, these big scale demos require a little bit of preparation if you want to be able to stay there for the whole 5-6 hours or possibly longer that you might be there. So first off, definitely do not go alone. You want to go with a friend or an affinity group so, you know, you can watch out for each other and always keep tabs on where everyone is. And
actually, I'd just like to say, when you go on demonstrations and when you go out with groups of people, generally other people will be familiar with this sort of buddy-style system, so make a point of finding someone.
Definitely, and keep your eye on them, at least one of them at all times, and know where they are. Well, if you're going to be outside, having your head covered is always a good idea, and if it's sunny, wear some sun cream. But keep in mind that tear gas is fat soluble, so you'll want to find a water or alcohol-based sun cream. You're going to want to wear loads of layers so you can, like, change your outfit if you need to, or, like, you can take stuff off and cut it up if you need it, or, you know, it just makes more sense than wearing a big woolly jumper, essentially. Take some waterproof layers in case the weather changes, it rains, blah, blah, blah. It's not nice being wet. Well, you know, wet, like, from the rain anyways. a terrible joke there. So if you're visually impaired, you'll definitely want to bring some spare glasses or contact lenses, especially contact lens wearers. If you get into major tear gas, the gas goes underneath the lens and will actually burn your eye and continue to do so. So, like, you'll want to be able to wash those out. Okay, so water and food is, like, a really important thing because if you're going to be out for a really long time, you can get hungry and stuff. And plus, you'll be, like, on an adrenaline high, and that's, like, really messes up your blood sugar level. So have something really sugary around, too, like some sweets or something or some juice.
Fruit is always good.
Yeah, definitely, and very healthy as well, full of vitamins.
Nature's candy, as indeed it is known. Actually, one of the things about that is that you mentioned being on an adrenaline buzz.
Yeah.
Adrenaline comes from your liver.
Yeah. So don't drink. Alcohol.
And it's not great for your liver. But to calm it down, apparently, rumour has it, I've been told, that bananas are very good for actually settling you down.
Really?
Yeah. If you come off an action or like a demonstration or something like that, and you get onto a train or something like that and you're still a bit hyper, try and eat some fruit, especially a banana. That's actually quite good for you.
Good to know. So another thing to consider is that if you have any medical issues like asthma or epilepsy or diabetes, you're going to want to have, if you take regular medication, you're going to want to have some of that on you, extra stuff. And then you want to make sure that your buddy in your affinity group knows about this so that they can deal with it in case of any sort of emergency. Now, it's not like we're recommending that people go up against the cops, but if you do want to, like, well, if you do want to get up close and personal, like, you probably, there's a high likelihood you're going to get hit. So padding is always good. Tummy, lower back, groin area are important and soft, fleshy areas. And then your head, obviously. And they're obviously going to go for your head because it's going to hurt the most. So wearing a hard hat or a motorcycle helmet or anything that you can get your hands on is a good idea. For tear gas, you're going to want to have some cloths and some vinegar or lemon juice. And if you soak the cloth in the lemon juice or the vinegar, we suggest apple cider vinegar, by the way, because it's the easiest to breathe in, then you'll be able to breathe temporarily in the tear gas until the cloth gets saturated and stuff.
Apparently burning paper is also good for that. Yeah. During the gas wars in Bolivia, the bank workers used to just throw sheaves of burning paper out onto the street to help the people.
Yeah, good use for bank records and stuff, I guess. And that's what they were doing in the Greek riots recently as well, burning lots of stuff on the streets. Goggles for
cars help, burning cars.
Yeah, burning. And if you're up against tear gas, goggles are always a useful thing to have as well. And some other useful but not necessarily essential items, but they'll be handy if you want to get creative, is stuff like duct tape, other types of tape like super glue, paint like Day-Glo paint, or red and black paint if you want to, you know.
I recommend chalk.
Chalk, yeah.
You have a couple of different colored chalks. Nice. It doesn't work well in the rural environment as much. It's more of a city thing.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind your footwear should be, trample proof. So steel-toed boots are always a must-have.
But in some places, they're actually considered a weapon, so check out.
Yeah, where is that?
I think somewhere in the UK. I think up at the G8 in Scotland, they were kind of banning you. But just check it out before you go.
Ridiculous. Okay. First aid equipment. So, in case someone gets hurt. Some tools. I don't know if you want to, fix the car after it's been burned. Paper and pencil. And if you can hide it somewhere in case you do get arrested, not that we think you should, then you can use it to document stuff, which can be very useful. And Sharpies. Sharpies are the universal one of the most useful things. Like duct tape and Sharpies.
What are Sharpies?
Oh, Sharpies are permanent markers. Yeah, so it's so useful. And good to write numbers on your arm if you need to not carry paper. And the big number 7. Exactly. So
all right, cool. I think the important thing though is just to try and pack light as well though. I know that sounds like loads of stuff, but
if you have an affinity group you can kinda spread out the love.
And things like a medical kit though, I think is a very good one.
Yeah.
And if you look up Action Medics, I think a lot of them live up in Leeds. They do courses, which are really good. So if you're into that type of thing, you should check them out.
Yeah.
It's a good skill to have. Yeah.
Definitely. Well, now we're going to go into the next track.
Yeah, we're going to have another track, actually.
Yeah.
Yo, Neil, what are we going to have?
It's called Song for Neil by Honeycube.
Women don't know what is expected. We'll be right back.
Yeah, we're back, and yeah, no, it's time for a vegan recipe. And yeah, by the way, yeah, that wasn't Honey Cube song for Neil. We'll play that soon, but that was like Amstram Gram by Louis Ling and the Bombs. It's like some French anarchist band that I can't really understand
good,
what they're
good
saying.
Good track, though. Solid
yeah, it
minute.
Was good. Yeah, it was. So we're going to make some vegan pecan pie. Mm. And it's already on the website. So if you go to the recipes part of the website, you can follow along with the recipe. But basically, you need 125 grams of plain flour, 75 grams of vegan margarine, a pinch of salt, and 3 to 4 tablespoons of soy milk or cold water. And that's for your pastry. And so to make your pastry, I cheat and I just put all my stuff in a food processor. And I kind of don't add all the liquid all at once. I add it just bit by bit so I get the right consistency, and I let the machine do it for me, and that's super lazy. But you can also, if you have very clean hands, just, you know, put all your stuff into a bowl minus some of the liquid and mix it all up, and then you'll just get a good consistency of dough. You'll know when it's ready, and then you can put it in the fridge for a little bit, because then you can roll it out a little bit better. And then put it in a pan, a pie pan, and put it in the oven at about 400 degrees for about 5 minutes, because you're going to want to pre-bake the pie crust before you put the pecan mixture in. And to make the pecan mixture, you need about 200 to 300 grams of toasted
unsalted. Do you cook it properly first?
Sorry, well, not entirely, because you do want the pie crust to cook with the pecan mix, because the pecan mix is going to be in the oven for a little bit as well.
So just stick in the pie mix for like 20 minutes?
No, like five.
Five, all right.
Just a little bit. Just like a little bit of pre-bakes. A little bit of extra love before the pecan mix. Okay, so for the pecan filling, you're going to want 200 to 300 grams of toasted, unsalted pecan nuts, 175 milliliters of water, 150 grams of unbleached white cane sugar, 75 grams of brown sugar. And yes, you do need both kinds of sugar because they are different. You need a pinch or two of salt, 35 grams of cornstarch or wheat starch, 4.5 tablespoons of rum. Yum. 2 tablespoons
more
of vegan.
More rum up,
yeah, yeah, more rum on the side. 2 tablespoons of vegan margarine, 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, and a little tiny dash of lemon juice, some ground clove, cinnamon, and some nutmeg for, you know, spiciness. So basically mix the cornstarch with a little bit of water into a bowl, and in the meantime put the rest of the water into a saucepan with the sugar over a high flame. Mix this and bring it to a boil, and then boil it for about 5 minutes. And then add the cornstarch and water mixture, a bit of salt, and whisk it continuously and quickly. And eventually this is going to get like a syrup, like a thick syrup. And so at that point, you just remove it from the heat and mix in the margarine, vanilla, alcohol, spices, pecan nuts. And you're going to, you know, mix it in and then pour it into your pie crust. And then you're going to bake that for 20 to 25 minutes until your pastry looks nice and golden brown. And keep in mind that you're going to bake it at about 400 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 200 Celsius, apparently. And your pecan,
full blast.
It's pretty high.
Turn it up to the top.
Yeah, but the pecan mix isn't going to solidify in the oven. It's like it's going to be kind of jiggly when you take it out. So don't be alarmed by that. But it'll set once it cools down. And yeah, the downside of this pie also is that you can't eat it like right away. Like you really have to leave it for at least 2 hours before you can pig out. So it is kind of like a little bit.
It's one to make
temptation.
You've got guests coming over, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, that kind of thing.
All right, cool. No, it's really good, actually. Is this also what you use to make anarchist pie? Because I noticed you've done like lacing on top of this.
Yes, I did. It's the same pastry, but just different filling. So
no.
Which is a good thing to note, to mention that the pastry is like, you can use it for anything.
It's also very luscious.
You like it?
I do. I couldn't eat loads of it, though, I have to say.
Yeah, it's probably not for people who have nut allergies either.
All right. They should recognize that by the title, though.
Yeah, hopefully.
Well, no, we'll put a small warning with it as well.
Yeah, we'll put a flashing warning on the website. No Patrick?
Nuts. No nuts.
No nuts.
All right, cool. So next up, we've got an interview
We're gonna go into an interview that we did with the Dissent Network in France, who are meeting this very weekend to talk about the NATO event coming up. And yeah, take it away. You will now listen to an interview with two members of the Dissent Network in France. Here's a little bit of background on Dissent. The network was formed in autumn of 2003 by a network of people who had previously been involved in radical ecological direct action and people involved in the PGA, the anti-war movement, the global anti-capitalist movement. The network has no central office, no spokespeople, no membership list. It's a mechanism for communication and coordination between local groups and working groups involved in building resistance to the G8 and capitalism in general. Dissent is open to anybody willing to work within the PGA, that's the People's Global Action Hallmarks, which contain, in short, a very clear rejection of capitalism, imperialism, and feudalism, all trade agreements, institutions, and governments that promote destructive globalization. The hallmarks also reject all forms and systems of domination and discrimination, and call for direct action in civil disobedience and support for social movement struggles. It advocates forms of resistance which maximize respect for life and oppressed people's rights, as well as the construction of local alternatives to global capitalism, and an organization philosophy based on decentralization and autonomy. After the initial creation of Dissent in 2003, the Dissent Network has grown to include groups from Germany, Belgium, Holland, Sweden, Spain, and most recently, France.
Chickpea here from Dissident Island Radio, and I am on the phone to two people from the group Dissent, and that would be Marina and Ben. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, very good to be talking with you today. So Dissent was very active and involved in the counter summit at Germany, the Germany G8 in 2007.
Yeah.
And so that was 2 years ago. So this year, in 2009, Dissent has decided to mobilize in reaction to NATO's big summit that's coming up in April. My question is...
Yeah.
Why has Dissent chosen to mobilize for NATO this year? Why NATO?
Why NATO? NATO pretends to spread democracy, but democracy cannot be imposed to people. They don't come to free up populations, but to defend private interests of their own. NATO also pretends to interfere against terrorism or for humanitarian reasons, but their actions are only spreading violence, like in Afghanistan recently. Moreover, NATO is now trying to take part in the political decisions of its members, especially concerning interior security, as it's part of their concept of global security. And this is affecting us directly. At the next NATO summit, for example, on the 3rd and 4th of April, members will decide for their new strategies for the years to come. They will discuss about a new way of taking decisions, which would make that if the majority decides for a new intervention, other members would have to follow and participate, which means that even if the people in the country are totally opposed to the war, they won't have any choice but participating to this shitty war. Also, NATO is destroying the borders between interior and external security, introducing their global security concept, which is quite new, with the creation of Council of Interior Ministers of NATO, where they're going to take decisions that will have to be applied in all the countries, like with Europe, actually, for example. Mm-hmm. And proposals have been done, like the possibility for NATO to interfere without a direct menace, what they call proactive, and the possibility to use preventive nuclear weapons.
Wow.
No joke. Of course, not like the big bomb A that was launched on Japan, but like small nuclear weapons, which are still nuclear weapons. And NATO members are also thinking about climate crisis for the consequences it will have on their own safety. They need a full access to resources and energy to and also to control frontiers for climate refugees. And here we see their way of dealing with a crisis situation, and we would not be really surprised that they apply this kind of scheme to the economic crisis actually going on.
And
but this we discuss on their summit, and it is only a personal theory we have. But for example, for going back to climate, some countries have made a proposal which is actually quite criticized even inside NATO, so we don't really know what's going to be about this proposal, but this proposal is quite incredible. They say that if a country like Russia, for example, if refusing to provide them resources, like gas, for example, considered as an aggression, and so needing a war reaction.
So basically, if a country A wants to take something from country B, and country B doesn't want to give it to country A can just start a war, and it's completely legitimate under NATO.
Exactly, and it won't be only the country A, it will be all the members of NATO, because if one member is involved in a war, all the members are.
Wow, that's crazy. I did not know that.
No, they are not really talkative about that.
And recently in Baden, in December of last year, there was an anti-NATO demonstration. And I was just wondering if you could tell us if there was any reaction to it in Germany. Do you know what they're trying to do in order to stop the counter-demonstrations and counter-summits?
To speak about this demonstration, it was not actually a demonstration against the NATO. It was a demonstration which impacts the region in Germany where the NATO is happening. So other regions in Germany where they try to establish, and in Bavaria, for example, they already have done this, a new demonstration law which cuts the demonstration rights basically to nothing. For example, just the hilarious aspects, black clothes are forbidden because they are implying violence, as are sunglasses and hoodies and sort like to apply to demonstration, it will be even more hard and basically impossible for people like us to go on the streets. This is a new law, PEC, that will be provided to the region where will happen the summit on the German side. And the demonstration was aiming against this. Of course, this is the same groups on the German side to mobilize against the NATO, so it was, of course, a thematic, considering also the new strategies of interior securitization of the NATO. But the demonstration itself was not an anti-NATO demonstration.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that.
The problem, repression, you are speaking, we still, in the moment, don't know what is expecting us. The situations in Germany and France are quite different. In Germany, they are already under surveillance. That since Heiligen Damm, there's a big knowledge about dissent groups and groups that are close to dissent. On the French side, dissent is relatively new. But on the other hand, you got a new fear of the extreme gauche, they call it here, of the extreme left. I don't know if you heard in England of the Katana cases. Well, and this is changing the mood here very very extremely, because it's the first cases they use terrorist laws in that size of mediatic impact. So they really mounted a terrorist case and changed the law on terrorism, which we haven't really by now analyzed, because it happened only in December. So for the repression to come, we can't really make lot of reviews.
Yeah.
Personally, we haven't received any repression by now.
Okay. On a more positive note, it sounds like you have quite a bit of interest in the meeting that you have organized for this weekend on the 16th to the 18th in Strasbourg. Maybe you can tell us some of the proposals that you have for the NATO counter summit. What sort of things are you thinking about putting on? And what for example, like for someone who has no idea, has never been to a counter summit, what can they expect to see when they get to NATO 2009 this year to demonstrate?
What they expect to see is first a nice camp that we hope to establish, convergence centers. The aim is to have convergence places in every three cities the summit will happen, which means Strasbourg, Kiel and Baden-Baden.
So there will surely be the infrastructure for the people to come. Then the Wednesday and the Thursday are supposed to be action days. Wednesday is probably we don't know yet what will happening. There is a proposal in workout that we will be listening to at the next weekend about NATO and climate. And the new, which all aims again to the strategy for uncertain world.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is a proposal on deconstructing the strategy of the inner security of the NATO, which is now again going into proposal together with the G20 event in London.
Yeah.
So the idea is to launch actions combining NATO and G20 and making the link obvious between the both institutions that are giving us so much pain. For Friday, they are supposed there are groups working on blockading Baden-Baden in the morning until the evening. Saturday there will be the blockade to block the event itself, the NATO summit in Strasbourg, and in the midday there's going to be the big demonstration with all the spectrums. They are not all doing the same thing, but the demo is supposed to be one thing that we do together.
Your meeting for the 16th to the 18th is in regards planning this counter-summit. And if I understand correctly, it will be the one and only international meeting before the event. Yeah. So what sort of groups have you heard from?
The main response we had was a question, was do you provide food and sleeping places?
People are not, we haven't demanded people for groups. So it's a complete surprise. There are people from No Borders, there are people from War Coalition, there are Antifa groups, there are autonomous groups with no name. There are mostly via speaking. Yeah, about autonomous groups.
Obviously, this meeting is to plan and various groups are coming together. But if for some reason people can't come to this meeting, which unfortunately when they hear this interview, it will be at the same time. So they would have missed it by the time they hear us talking. What can they do from, for example, London or Madrid or Rome? What can people do without coming to Strasbourg this weekend? And how can people get involved?
One of the background ideas of this meeting was not only to prepare the NATO actions and protests, it's also a trial to re-establish the network of dissent in Europe and abroad. The already existing dissent groups, networks that were there, they are still the people, they are still there. What we try to do is to call them back and to reflect again about our aims and our position on the international level. Therefore, the last part of the agenda of the weekend is the point communication, how to establish a further communication considering the NATO planning of action and the further communication as European network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that basically we noticed these factors that the movements against international institutions were a bit out of steam. And we consider this as a major problem because those institutions have a strong impact on our lives. They are tools for the overlords to give an institutional form to their projects, like WTO, and most of the political and economical decisions are today taken at a global level. They are established in the lobbies of these institutions, taking us further and further from direct democracy and struggling at a local level seems inextricable from a global struggle. And moreover, we think that these convergent mobilizations are creating international networks and solidarity, and we do believe that the fact that these movements are getting a bit out of steam is mainly due to institutionalization. Every year now it's a bit the same, you know, it's GA, it's quite done a bit always the same, and it's sometimes becoming more like a show than like a real protest with a real efficiency. Really trying to find the critic analysis and really to search on finding new ways. Because what's made the success of Genoa, for example, is that the police were not expecting us to act out of the red zone. They were prepared for us to attack the red zone, not for us to attack capitalism on another level. And we managed to surprise them. And I think this is the recipe of efficient mobilization, is to create a surprise, to always evolve, to always find alternatives, to be... Voilà, our only limits are the limits of our imagination, and we got to work on to mobilize differently, to create different mobilization.
Well, excellent. That's really well put. You guys don't want this just to turn into another activist vacation, you know? Like, this isn't just going to be about, like, going to Germany and hanging out with people who have similar politics. And that's what's really cool about your call-out as well, is that it's not just about this one time and, like, reinventing the wheel every time there's a new counter summit. It's about creating allegiances between the various networks that already have similar politics and similar ideas, but also like getting there and doing something and using that time, you know, to do something concrete. Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for offering the time.
Giving us a voice.
If you would like to contact the Dissent Network to get involved, email dissent_fr@riseup.net. You can also check out www.dissent.fr for more information.
Okay. So yeah, our competition has actually been a roaring success. We do have a winner, which is shocking. Somebody has written to us at DissentIsland@riseup.net.
There's actually somebody listening. And it's amazing.
The winner is Ben Gringo. And the answer he gave, of course, was La Maddalena, which is in between Corsica and Sardinia. Ben also wrote to tell us that the G8 takes place in between the 8th and 10th of July, and that steel-toe caps are illegal in Germany on demos. Unfortunately, Ben, you only get one T-shirt. So, you know, but well done, and we will give you a T-shirt next time we see you.
A star to Ben.
So the next thing we're going to have a little talk about in terms of preparing for demos is a thing called the dance steps. Which is basically kind of, most of us have been there where you're sitting around and the cops are sitting around and all of a sudden something happens and it's kind of hard to know what the cops are doing because, you know, they don't really talk about it.
And there are loads of people.
Yeah,
like,
and it's
just
always
chaos.
Yeah. So maybe this would help you.
To understand where they're coming from, what they're intending to do, and if you have an idea, then you, because they do basically the same thing every time, at least in this country. I don't know about, in exotic other places, or even in other countries in Europe, sometimes they probably, but the tactics are pretty standard. So, like, if you can see the way that the police are moving, then you can know how they're going to try and deal with the crowd situation, essentially.
Mm. And then maybe you be able to figure out some way of outflanking them. So the first dance step is the good old kettle. So officers will form a line and pen you in, preferably on the pavement. The number two is that they'll push into the crowd and divide it in half, which is usually kind of...
It's a divide and conquer kind of tactic.
So they'll kettle in two groups rather than one. Number three is that they'll kind of lash into you with batons, horses, or CS spray.
Which really sucks. Yeah.
So it just kind of lowers morale. People start getting pissed off going home, and then the hardcore remain, and then they can just really kind of get stuck into them. Number four is a kind of series of charges that kind of push you down the street. So the cops will just, like, rush at you, stand their ground, and then kind of reform their line and then push again. Then kind of in a related way, if the crowd is throwing missiles, they'll kind of charge you. And it's really hard to throw stuff at cops when you're running. So, you know, that kind of suits their objectives. And then finally, there is...
the shift change, and I don't know how this is a tactic, actually. It's on a list that we kind of found on the internet, to be honest. We haven't come up with this ourselves. Are you kidding?
No, we're not that clever.
We're not that clever. But, yeah, I mean... Basically, the shift change is, I guess, something to watch out for more than anything, because it is a police tactic, and it is kind of like disorienting, and you know, you're kind of standing around for a long time, and all of a sudden, like, fucking loads of new people show up in like Reich, and you just freak out, and it's, you know, it's probably all about agitation and just like fucking with people, essentially. And
yeah, but I guess the thing to think about with that is that, like, the shift change is loads of people who aren't familiar with the situation coming in to deal with it, so that's when probably the police are most vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they haven't got the orders, they don't know the faces in the crowd to watch out for or whatever, so, you know, maybe that would be a good time to get stuck in.
Not that we're endorsing that kind of activity in any way whatsoever.
Never would we dream of encouraging people to get stuck in. But, you know, as Mel said earlier, maybe it needs a riot.
Actually, I was just going to interrupt with the action of the week. Action of Fortnite.
What's that?
Well, I thought it was a very good action this morning.
Oh, yes.
When three suffragettes went to visit the Department for Transport, did its doors in, glass doors, put a lot of green paint all over it. Thought that was really good.
Good stuff.
Sorry, so that's my action in Fortnite. That one caught my eye today.
Anything coming up?
Oh, dude, we report the news. Well, we kind of make it as well, but I'm not going to... I don't know. There's a flash mob,
there
actually.
There is, yeah. There's a flash mob at Heathrow.
Tomorrow, Saturday, in Heathrow. Terminal 5, about 12-ish. come along, wear a T-shirt of appropriateness. But keep it covered up until the appropriate time. You'll know when. And so go along to that. That should be good. But back to Patrick.
Yeah, and going to do the Prisoner of the Month. We missed out on this last month. Before we do, just want to give a shout out to Sam. We think you rock too. So this month's prisoner is Marie Jeanette Mason, who is in Missouri, United States. Basically, this is kind of old information, but it's hard to, there hasn't really been much update since December. But she, as of December, she was awaiting sentencing, having pleaded guilty to involvement in ELF arson against university building, carrying out genetically modified crop tests. She also pled guilty to conspiring to carry out ELF actions and admitted to involvement in 12 other ELF actions. Marie is expected to receive a sentence in between 15 and 20 years. So basically, people are asking for letters to Marie while she's incarcerated waiting for sentences. Letters for the Outside will serve as a lifeline to keep her spirits up. So basically, what you need to do with the letters is you need to have a complete return address, and they need to be addressed exactly as I will tell you and as will be on our website for them to be accepted. If you send a letter and it gets returned, please let her campaign know. There'll be a link on their website, and there will be... There'll be a kind of links and more info on our website. So if you want to send a letter of support, send it to Marie Jeanette Mason, Clinton County Jail, 1347 East Townsend Road, St. John's, Missouri, which is MI 48879, United States. And the website to go to find out more about Marie and her case is freemarie.org.
It's a really long address.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they put that in to fuck with you, you know? Just the man keeping you down. All right, we're going to go into one last track and then an interview that I did with someone from Warren want on the, about the G20. I start to fucking try and start my dump and breathe again, cause all I want is you.
Hi, this is Patrick for Distant Island, and I'm here with Dave Tucker from War on Want, and we're going to talk a little bit about the G20, what they've done in the past, and what they're likely to kind of come up with in their meeting in London in April this year. So, Dave, do you want to start by telling us a little bit about what the G20 has done in the last 10 years, how it emerged, and what it's achieved?
Well, the G20 is essentially, like all these G groups, it's a kind of informal get-together of rich and powerful countries and leaders of the world. There was the G7, which turned into the G8, and prior to that, the G22, G33. And the thing to remember is they haven't actually got any formal power, per se. It's a kind of closed-door talking shop where deals can be cut between the countries that have the most money and the most influence. The G20 is part of that kind of setup, but it was originally brought together as finance ministers, and its remit's really just around the global financial system, a little bit around the IMF, the World Bank, and some of these financial institutions. But essentially, it's a level lower than the heads of state. It was brought together in 1999 partly as a reaction to the financial crisis that was happening in Southeast Asia, when they realized that there's a great deal of instability, a great deal of damage being done, and that some kind of cooperation would be necessary. So they've been in existence for about 10 years, but really in the background. And what's happened just recently is that actually, Sarkozy, the leader of France, has taken a political opportunity to bring the G20 to the fore and saying, right, this is a global financial crisis. The G20 is the right place to discuss this. And actually, underneath that, there's a real implicit recognition that there are rising powers. There's China, there's India, there's Brazil, there's South Africa, and so on. And having the G7 or the G8 is just not enough anymore. It's looking increasingly ridiculous and increasingly irrelevant, really. So in that sense, the G20 is starting to maneuver into a position where it can take over from the G8 just because it's far more realistic, but you have to include these other big powers and increasingly rich powers in the club. Now, the thing is, though, that it's okay to convene the G20 because a lot of these finance ministers, bankers, are coming from the same background, they think the same way, and they can have these private members' clubs, like, where they can agree amongst themselves that how to fix the global financial system. But the G8 is a sort of higher level, and it's much more political, and it's always been about, these are the people who think like us, these are the people that we can get on with. And I think that the members of the G8 are still reluctant to give up that power and to let people like India and China into that club, because they come from such different mindsets, really. So I don't think in the longer term there's any prospect of the G8 just staying as the primary, the top dog, the place where all the decisions are made, and it will get bigger. But that's not going to happen for a few years yet, at least.
In terms of the decisions that have had an effect on the ground in regards to trade and liberalisation and that, I mean, what role has the G20 played?
Well, the G20, as I say, it's a place where the leaders have come together to try and fix primarily the financial system as they see it. And that does involve, to a certain extent, things like trade and the wider agendas. But essentially, they're just concentrating on how to get the banks lending to each other again, how to salvage the system with the minimum of interference, really, so that they can stabilize things and then they can go back to business as usual. So what we're seeing happening in November at the last time that they got together in Washington, D.C., and what we're expecting to happen in London in April, is that the recommendations they'll come out with are just aimed at stabilizing the system. They're not going to take in the kind of systematic and systemic reform that's really needed across trade, across tax, across the environment, and so on and so forth. And it's just going to be a really partial solution. Furthermore, I mean, that solution is just going to be to throw more money at the problem, because you can see what has come out so far, recapitalizing the banking system and so on. Essentially, give them our money and then employ the same people to try and sort it out, and they hide behind the excuse that, oh, well, these are very, very complicated and only the people who have been working in the sector can really understand it, which to any normal people just sounds completely insane, frankly. You know, you even look at the regulatory system and they say, well, it's the regulators weren't keeping an eye on it and so on and so forth. These are the same people who've come out of the same system and the same mindset again. So it's a closed circle. They're not really, they can't even get their heads around the kinds of change that we need to see right across society, right across the financial system, and across the global governments, frankly. The G20 is looking at the financial architecture, but it exists in this whole ideology of neoliberalism, of free markets, of competition, and so on and so forth. And, you know, the bankers and the people involved in this financial system are really at the front, at the vanguard of pushing for free trade. They don't want any restrictions on them. They don't want any considerations about what hurts people to get in the way of them making profits. So the G20 is absolutely solidly in that mindset. And as such, we don't think that it's can come up with anything really meaningful in terms of reform. They might have a bit of window dressing, a bit of re-regulation, and an admission that things have gone too far, but no admission that they're fundamentally wrong in the first place. Quite apart from the mindset, if you look at who's in the G20, it's bigger than the G8, but you're still excluding vast swathes of the world. There's no representation from Africa. I mean, South Africa is on there, slightly tokenistically, but and most of South America is not on there as well. These are areas of dire poverty and millions and hundreds of millions of people, and they have no voice and no representation in this process. So what kind of solution do we think that the G20 can come out with?
Looking at the membership list, do you have, for example, Argentina and Brazil, which both have kind of, which are kind of broadly part of the pink tide in Latin America. You've got quite poor countries. I mean, Indonesia, India, I mean, they're obviously kind of developing and they are powerhouses in their own right in regional context. But I mean, is there broad equality in terms of decision making within the G20, or is it mostly driven by the northern countries or the developed countries?
Well, I don't, as far as I know, there's not like a formal decision making process in the way that the WTO has a one member, one vote, supposedly. And we all know that that's absolutely riven with bullying and power politics. But rather, in the G20, it's going to be a case of arm twisting and sort of personal negotiation, if you like. and the reason why places like Indonesia and India are included is partly or largely because of their massive populations, rather than a recognition that they are powers to be dealt with. I mean, India is a special case. And as it's really becoming part of the club, but Indonesia, I can't see that at all. So in that sense, I think the decision making will be quite unbalanced. It's still going to be driven by the US and by the EU. And because of their military and financial might, that is, you know, that's going to determine the power politics that happen inside the meeting, rather than the fact that they're at the table and should be grateful.
So moving on then from what the G20 is there any forums where people can kind of get together to either protest or look at alternatives?
Yeah, there are actually in the next few months several things coming up. I'd really emphasise that, as we say that this G20 process is illegitimate, we absolutely have to keep building democracy from below, and a participatory democracy, if you like, where citizens and people on the grassroots level are getting involved in the political process and helping to create an alternative, because the G20 and these sort of associated groupings are so far off the mark at the moment that it's hard to see anything useful coming out of that. So with that in mind, we are running an event actually on the 28th of February called 6 Billion Ways to Change the World, which is together with people like Friends of the Earth and World Government Movement and various others in a place called Rich Mix in East London. And we'd really love people to get down there, because it's one of the first attempts really to try and join up these dots and join up these issues and make things a bit clearer to ordinary people. So we all know that there's climate problems, there's finance problems, that there's problems with food and petrol and so on and so on. But how are these things all linked? And we would really want to start making a social movement in the UK that can agitate from below for this kind of change. So that's on the 28th of February, and it has a website which is www.6billionways.org.uk. So we'd encourage people to go to that website and check it out, and it will have films, debates, workshops, and there's a gig in the evening as well. The other major mobilization coming up will be around the G20 itself, which is being held in London, I think in Watford in fact, from the 2nd of April, and we'll be mobilizing for a huge march on the 28th of March in central London, and that's going to focus around jobs and global justice and the environment, and really try and make these links again between activists who have not necessarily been talking to each other so much so far. And that, more details will come on our website, which is waronwant.org. And I believe the plans aren't firmed up yet, but on the 1st of April there'll also be another protest on an international level with international contingents, and probably slightly more radical as well. So keep your eyes peeled for that. That'll be on our website in due course as well.
Yeah, so, yeah. Thanks for Warren Mont for supplying us with that interview. So yeah, there are a lot of kind of mobilizations going on for the G20. There's like Stop the War Coalition and a load of different NGOs and that. And it's all very wordy, but I mean, as far as I can tell from my limited kind of searches, there isn't a hell of a lot of kind of actual kind of, you know, let's shut the conference down type thing. And, you know, these are kind of very powerful people and in some cases are kind of unelected as well, which kind of robs them of any sort of legitimacy. So, I mean, I think it's kind of ripe for some sort of a radical direct action campaign against it. It's in an urban setting that suits us quite well, seeing as it's not on a fucking island, like in the middle of the North Sea or something like that. So yeah, I reckon that, you know, anything that we find in terms of kind of pretty hardcore actions against the G20, we're going to post up on our website. We'll also put up the ones that were being talked about in the interview there, the 6 billion ways to change the world, because, you know, you never know, you might learn something.
And the thing is, though, with the G20 in London, it's not just about coming to our website and looking up what radical action is happening. Like, if you really want to do something, find people that you want to do it with and do it. I mean, it can happen, and it does happen, and it has happened in past summits. Like, and dispersed and very sporadic and scattered actions is exactly what, you know, the police can't really deal with effectively. And so, in many ways, you'd be doing something really awesome, but that's an endorsement of sin. So I shouldn't have said that.
We'd like to withdraw the last comment.
Yeah, I'll withdraw that statement.
Please don't show up with petrol bombs.
Show absolutely no initiative.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, just go shopping those days. Because, you know, they really need it. You know.
Economy's gone to pot, man.
Set up loads of bank accounts and then go shopping.
Anyway, speaking of which, are we doing a credit card special?
We are. We're going to be doing one probably on February 6th. And yeah, we have a lot of reading to do, guys, so that we can understand it and talk about it. Yeah.
We're going to learn it, then explain it to you in 4 simple sentences.
Yeah. It's going to be in a Zen-like way.
Right. Okay, anyway, and the last little bit of information is that Distant Island are putting on another party. Distant Dubs 2 in the London and Brighton again.
Woo.
On January 31st, and we've got a wicked lineup again. Eli Muff is playing, Depot, Luke Envoy again, Hobo Cop, and young Noel Edmonds. Plus more to be confirmed. There's going to be some dubstep, jungle, hardcore, good old mashup, hopefully. Okay.
There'll also, the party starts at 10, but if you want to turn up early and get some food and films and info into you before you get off your face, please do.
Yeah.
We'll be opening doors at 6.
Yeah, it's free from 6 to 10. If you want to come, there's going to be pamphlets, books, food on donation, films, maybe a couple of workshops, see what we can pull out of the bag, you know what I mean? But if you want to get involved, give us an email, distantisland@riseup.net.
Yeah.
Plug. Anyway, right. Next we have Danger Man.
Danger Man. Does Danger Man want to introduce himself or anything like that?
Hello. I don't know what to say. I'm going to try my best. I can say I'm going to try my best. I'm not quite sure what I'm doing. I'm never quite sure what I'm doing. I hope it turns out all right. Most times it does. But I can't promise anything.
Okay, let's begin.
All right.
Yeah. Tabith, you're talking crazy. Fucking crazy!
just say the Liverpool fan. It's home. We'll be right back.
someone to see that the plants are watered, someone to make sure the place is clean, someone to make sure dinner is waiting, someone to call for theater tickets, someone to make up those cheap excuses. What we need is
Power! Power! you want and try not to hate what you don't understand. The time that you waste growing up, we're giving up. You might be older, that's not enough. But you aim from your rate, what's right or wrong? You can't relate, maybe all alone. So close your eyes, then go to sleep, and try to forget what you did.
to the sounds of Winnipeg. The wide breathing of a nocturnal city in this sad, sad world. Listen to the sounds of Winnipeg. If you're sad and like beer, I'm your lady.
You can bruise us, but you'll have to answer too. it feels good. Your life, you like it well, but surely time will come.
I've seen heaven, I've seen hell.
Like Ivan, born under the Brixton sun, whose cave is called Spyburn. At the end, the harder they come. You know it means your mercy. They cut him with a gun. No need for the white man riot. Say goodbye to the Brixton sun. You can't crush us, you can bruise us, but you'll have to want some too. Oh.
About the tax, no government line in my rhyme. And please, I bet, don't mention debt or jail or bail or the warrant sale. A tax on the air, a tax on your soul. Sign up here for complete control. Shout poll tax prisoners, set them free. Your community charge on the TST.
The shutdown on pavement, waiting in death row. This game was called survivor. I said heaven, I said hell. You can crush us, you can bruise us, but you'll have to once or two.
What the-
You're gonna die, gonna die, gonna die for your government, die for your country, that shit. You're gonna die, gonna die, gonna die for your government, die for your country, that shit.